It's our great pleasure to welcome Dr. Emma Gilchrist to speak to us this morning, and a pleasure to have you also, Belinda, with us today. A warm welcome to you both. Dr. McGilchrist began his professional life as a literary scholar, and it's quite evident in his later writings. His love of literature, poetry, and the like comes through in his writings. He later trained in medicine, was a neuroimaging researcher in the States for a while, and then was a consultant psychiatrist in London for some years. Dr. McGilchrist is a philosopher, a writer, and the proof of that is a massive contribution he made in 2009 with this book here, The Master and His Emissary, The Divided Brain and the Making of the Western World. You'll be pleased to know, Dr. McGilchrist, that this was a set text for many of our ministers in their training, well, half of it anyway, the second half of it. So some of us here are quite familiar with that. Dr. McGilchrist is exploring the hemispheric nature of the brain and perception, really. Well, if you think that's a massive work, more lately, there's a two-volume, and here I need super-duper muscles to hold these up, two-volume work, The Matter with Things, Our Brains, Our Delusions, and the Unmasking of the World. Unmaking of the World. Sorry, what did I say? Unmasking, unmaking of the world. Thank you. Our Brains, Our Delusions, and the Unmaking of the World. That might have been a Freudian slip. You may have to reflect on that later. So a massive contribution. And I think somewhere you've said, sir, that this might be the last of your major writings. But like most writings, we will see if that's the case. Talking practically, can you ensure that you get back in time so we can make the most of our time with Dr. McGilchrist? A warm welcome to you, sir. Thank you so much for coming to be with us today.
Well, it's a very great pleasure to be here today. And I'm going to speak largely philosophically this morning about the mess we find ourselves in. Who do we think we are? I would say we no longer have the foggiest idea what a human being is, what our relationship with the natural world is, and with the cosmos at large. And yet, everything important for us and our fulfillment as moral, intellectual, and spiritual beings depends on knowing more. You're going to hear a lot of words from me, so I'm going to begin with a piece of music. So things will be ecumenical today, but I think this is a quite astonishingly profound spiritual outcry worth many volumes, including the ones I've written. I want to talk to you today about the brain. It's bipartite structure is something I've been studying for about 30 years. And why the brain? Not because the brain is the origin of consciousness. I believe it is a permitter of consciousness, and that consciousness is therefore sculpted by the brain. Our consciousness, we cannot deny, has something to do with the brain, and something to do with its structure will tell us something about the structure of our consciousness. In that sense, it's like the banks of a river. The banks of a river are not the river. They don't make the river happen, but they do shape where the river is going. You may have heard people say that anything to do with hemispheres is just nonsense, it's pop psychology. And part of my heart goes out to people who say that, because a lot of what used to be said was in fact untrue. And so most of the things that have passed into common parlance about the hemispheres are wrong. And I sometimes, I'm not going to do death by PowerPoint, I sometimes put up a slide from the internet, which is one of the better ones, actually, which describes right and left, and there's about 20 things in each column, and there's only one thing that's actually right. So we have to go back to square one, and anybody who thinks they know about hemisphere differences but hasn't read my work, I would humbly say doesn't know what they're talking about. Three important questions. Why is the brain divided? Why is it asymmetrical? and why is the band of fibres that connects the two hemispheres at their base, the corpus callosum, so much inhibitory in its effect? A brain, we are told, wrongly, is a sort of computing machine. But whatever it is, you'd think that its power came from making connections between neurons. That's what it does. So why is there a whopping divide down the middle? Why are the two halves asymmetrical? Importantly, there are people whose brains are not asymmetrical and they have many problems. And indeed, people with schizophrenia, one of the findings is that they often have either no brain asymmetry, the normal asymmetry is not present, or they have a reversed one. So these things are important, and what they suggested to me a long time ago, when I was perverse enough to ignore the advice of all my friends and mentors and research this topic, was there's something here. We may have got it wrong, but just to have given the wrong answer to the question is not to have dispensed with the question. The question is important. What's going on here? And I think there is one simple thing to say, which is absolutely in keeping with the evolutionary model of the development of life, which is that we need two different ways of attending to the world at once. And for this reason, all the animals we know that have brains have divided brains, and they have asymmetry of those brains. And even the most ancient creature that we know that has the origins of a brain, a neural network, is actually a sea anemone called Nematocella vectensis that lives off the Isle of Wight, 700 million years old, where it is only a tad older than the average of the general population, but it actually already has an asymmetry built into its network. Why? Every creature has to know how to get and not be got. And this is solved by having two ways of disposing your consciousness towards the world. One is the one in which you try to acquire things, catch a rabbit, pick up a seed rapidly, skillfully, quickly, ahead of another bird, pick up a twig to build a nest. In other words, to manipulate the world and to make it more habitable. That is incredibly important. But unfortunately, that means that's so important that it requires one part of one's brain to be focused simply on utility and power, and that is the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere of the brain, meanwhile, is doing the looking out for everything else, things that are not already known to be of use to us, not something familiar, a seed, a rabbit, I need it, I get it, but to look at things as they are, complex, not necessarily certain, connected with all other beings. And this requires a different kind of attention, which is that offered by the right hemisphere, which is broad, sustained, vigilant, and open. There's nothing revolutionary in my stating this. This is known. All around the world, neurologists will confirm what I've just said. And I think the explanation is, as I say, this evolutionary one. But attention is not something simple. I used to think attention was just, as I had been taught, another cognitive function. But attention is not. Attention requires consciousness. A machine cannot attend. It can do certain actions, but it cannot possibly attend. But attention is how we bring the experiential world into being. And the nature of the attention we dispose changes what we find there. And what we find there changes the way in which we think we'll pay attention in the future. And so we can quickly get locked into a certain kind of attention. And to cut to the chase, I believe that nowadays we are over-enthralled by the kind of attention offered by the left hemisphere, which is for utility, power, for the acquisition of things, rather than the understanding of what it is that we're living amongst and in. So attention changes the world. And the existentialist French philosopher Louis Lavelle in the early part of the last century said, love is a pure attention to the existence of the other. And Simone Weil said something very similar, that attention is a kind of love. Now, you can pay very different kinds of attention, and there's a certain kind of attention we're encouraged to take nowadays, which is detached, which is scrutinizing something as an object for use. This is the attention paid by the left hemisphere. And they bring into being two kinds of world. What are those worlds like in brief? to summarize a couple of thousand words, two pages, a lot more words. Effectively, the left hemisphere sees a world in which there are isolated pieces that are familiar. They're known, we already know we want them. They're unconnected from anything else. They are decontextualized. They're general in nature. All their quiddity, their peculiarity, their individuality, their uniqueness has been lost. And they are abstract in nature, disembodied, and effectively lifeless. And this is very useful for manipulating things. You don't want to be too troubled about the liveliness and the complexity of what you're dealing with if you want a meal. On the other hand, the right hemisphere sees that nothing is fixed and ultimately certain. And we now know from physics that this is a reality at every level, that nothing is ever wholly determined or fixed. It is connected to everything else. It is alive and flowing. It's never static. It's always in a process of change. And in that process, all kinds of things are involved that are not necessarily explicit, as they must be to the left hemisphere. The left hemisphere sees something explicit that it knows, it wants, it gets it. But the right hemisphere realizes that much of the meaning in what we observe is actually not easily put into language and not necessarily explicit. It's all the stuff that is between the lines. It's the things that are not said. It's the way in which things are said. It's the tone of voice, the facial expression, the body language. It's metaphor. It's irony. It's humor. All these things that give life to language and turn it away from its destiny to become a dishwasher manual and become something that can lift up our souls. What's a soul? Well, I'll talk about that after the break. So, in one version of the world, that of the left hemisphere, what you see is a map. And a map only contains some information. And it's not worse for containing only some information. If it had a lot of information, you wouldn't be able to use it. So it's useful, local, usable in the short term, but effectively wrong. It's untruthful. It doesn't care about the truth. It's only interested in what's practically useful now. In the other right hemisphere version, we see what is mapped, the real terrain in which we live. And it's truer to what is, but harder to comprehend and to express in language, and therefore less useful. But for a broader or longer term understanding, it is essential. Now, these two ways of looking at the world bring into being different aspects of the world, and we need them both. But we also, importantly, need one of them to be in charge of the other. It's the right hemisphere that sees more. Literally sees more, is more intelligent, and I mean both its emotional and social intelligence is greater than that of the left hemisphere, but also its cognitive intelligence. Old-fashioned IQ is measuring what the right hemisphere, not the left, is largely giving. I won't go into the evidence, it's all contained in my writing, but today I'm just giving you some results. So we need them both, but we need the right hemisphere to be in charge. But unfortunately, there is a principle in psychology called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which you've probably already observed, even if you don't know what to call it, which is that people who know very little think they know everything. And people who know a lot realize how very little they know. And in some ways, the left hemisphere is like the pub bore who knows everything, and the right hemisphere is the one that's going, hang on, it may not be like that. It may not be so simple. There may be more going on, and there may be more points of view than the one you're embracing. The left hemisphere wants things to be clear, quick and dirty, black and white, whereas the right hemisphere is very happy with the idea that we have to live with ambiguity, with contradictions, because this is also part of the truth of experience. Now, what I'm going to suggest is that there are various aspects, because after all, I'm speaking today to people who are involved in work which is part of the spiritual life. I'm going to suggest that in a world where we largely favor the left hemisphere's vision of just stuff that has no spiritual meaning, just random stuff bumping into other bits of random stuff without any purpose or design or meaning, that this vision of the world is going to make it very hard for us even to come to realize something which is our birthright, which we intuitively know, which our imagination tells us all the time is the case. And by the way, imagination is not turning your back on truth, as Wordsworth and Coleridge exemplified both in what they wrote and explicitly in what they said on the matter. Fantasy takes you away from reality, but imagination takes you deeper into reality, is indeed your best chance of ever understanding that reality. So it takes us away from these aspects and instead offers us the sort of blankness that you get from Dawkins, Dennett, and other people whose names begin with D. Now, and some of them begin with other letters, it's true. So the first is otherness. So you can see that the left hemisphere is concerned with what it already knows, what it already wants, and it's not interested in the otherness of what it's encountering. And all experience is an encounter. See, I want to put to rest in your minds two possible ways of looking at reality, and they are to many people the only two possibilities, and that has dominated our thinking. And getting rid of that idea is incredibly important. What are those two ways? One is that there just is stuff out there, and if we want to understand it, we just register it like machines, like Geiger counters, like photographic plates, and that is what the truth is. But there is another equally pernicious but opposite view, which is the view of postmodernism, that we just make it all up ourselves. Now, I believe there is a reality. I actually believe that you people really do exist. You're not just a fantasy in my mind. But I also know that what is in the room and what is all around us in the beauty of this world is stuff that comes to life for us when we encounter it. So all experience is an encounter. It's a relationship. It's not a thing. And I argue in my latest book, The Matter with Things, that actually, this may sound very odd, that relationships are prior to what philosophers call relata, the things that are related. How can that be? Quite easily, because whatever it is, you can't start from something and then connect it to something else, because what it is already determined by the relationships in which it stands. We are not atoms. We are parts of a society, of a culture, of a species that gave rise to us, of the natural world. We come out of nature. We do a lot of naturing, and then we go back into nature. So this is a very important idea, because in an encounter, both parties are altered. Depending on how you attend to the world, you not only change what is there to be found, but you also change yourself. And if you become in the habit of attending in a certain way, certain faculties of yours will atrophy. You will become a simpler, more mechanical being. So otherness. Conceptions and words, which is how we tend to manage our knowledge of reality, are important, but they only go part of the way. And all the really important things, like God and love, are not easily spoken about or reduced to language or concepts. They have to be experienced. And you can't sit outside them wondering what they might be like. You have to get in and experience it. I can't explain to somebody what love is if they've never experienced it. And the same is true of the divine. So the right hemisphere is the one that alerts us to the unfamiliar and the unknown and says, hang on, there's more going on here than you, the left hemisphere, have jumped to the conclusion that there is. That's another interesting point on Passant, is that people think that maybe the right hemisphere, being more intuitive, jumps to conclusions. It's much better guide to reality. It is much more in touch with reality. And the left hemisphere is frankly deluded. I mean, I'm not using language in a flowery way there. It just is on its own. If your right hemisphere is not working, the left hemisphere will be completely deluded. Deluded in the sense that, you know, seriously ill patients with mental health problems become deluded. They believe impossible things. So the left hemisphere sees truth as a matter of internal consistency, where the right hemisphere sees truth as a relationship. And interestingly, the root of the word truth is the same as the root of the word trust. And so you have to trust in something other than yourself. Another thing is uncertainty. Living with uncertainty is very important. I hope I'm not treading on anybody's toes here, but I'm intrinsically suspicious of people who are certain about almost anything. If there's anything that is very nearly certain, it's that anyone who's certain is certainly wrong. And in order to encounter the realm of the sacred and the divine, we have to suspend our categories, our judgments, and be open to something that is beyond them, about which we cannot be certain, but that we can at least know that we're experiencing it and that it's real in that sense. So the left hemisphere is incapable of what the poet Keats called negative capability. What he meant by that was the ability to remain in doubts and uncertainties without, as he said, irritably reaching after fact and reason. There are certain things where it's better to suspend judgment and be aware without necessarily closing down on a certainty. If you close down too soon, you lose what it is that you are encountering. So the left hemisphere is thus relatively incapable of the tentative, careful reaching out towards what lies beyond what we think we already know. And then there's something called betweenness. At least it's called betweenness by me. It's a neologism, but when we need it and we haven't got it, so there it is now. What is betweenness? People use it now thinking that I mean something different from what I mean. I don't just mean rapport. I don't even mean compassion, although these are parts of it. But what I mean is something that is present everywhere, in every shred of existence. So in an electrical circuit, where is the electricity? Is it in the positive pole? No. Is it in the negative pole? No. Is it in the space between them? No. It's in the whole ensemble of the negative pole, the positive pole, the wire that connects them, and then suddenly something else completely other comes into being, which is a dynamic force. Now, life is very much like this, that if we hold things together, we find that something arises out of them, which is a third element, which is more than either of the first two. This is how creativity happens. And if we collapse it into one or the other, no, I just want a positive pole. I just want a negative pole. I got a magnet. I don't like the South Pole. I just want the North Pole. You cut it in half. You've still got a South Pole. You've just got a shorter magnet. So this is very important. And there's something here that, well, it's a complex idea in Hegel, but I'm trying to make it simple, called sublation, in which you bring things together and some third party comes about through that conjunction. And this means there's something very important about context. Context changes everything. A simple and amusing example is how context can reverse the meaning. I mean, there are all kinds of ways in which I could be reported as saying something, and a soundbite could go around the world saying McGilchrist said this, but they didn't realize that I was saying it ironically, or that it was a counterpoint to something else I just said before. So context is everything. And there's a nice and amusing vignette of this, which is cereal packets in America. So there are four sizes of cereal packets. There's jumbo, which means very large. There's economy, which means large. There's family, which means medium. And finally, there's large, which means small. So you see that context changes absolutely everything. And music is contextual and all in relationships. And I think that the idea of the world as music rather than as language is a very, very important one. Music is so deep that we can't go beyond it. What is it? What does it say? We can never articulate. But no two pieces of music, if they're any good, are at all the same. Each one brings a new experience to us. This is unique. How does it do this? It uses the same elements, notes. And, you know, you can take a note and play a note and it means nothing. Put 20,000 of them together and you've got a wonderfully moving cantata by Bach. You know, how does this happen? Because it's in the relationships between the notes that make the melody, make the harmony, make the rhythm. And in the reality of modern physics, particles are not actually little tiny ping-pong balls. They are the actualization at a point of the potentia in a field. That field is a field of potential that can be made to collapse into a certainty for a short period. So this has implications, because making something explicit changes the nature of the entity. If I read you a beautiful poem by Hardy that he wrote during the period when his wife died, 1912 to 13, there was an amazing outpouring of his grief in astonishing poetry. If I translate it into everyday language, what it is saying is it's very hard when someone you love dies. Well, there are no real prizes for that. But is that really what the poems say? Not at all. You have to read each one, because it says exactly what it says, just in those words and in no other words. Decontextualizing utterly changes what we find. You can take the world apart and find that it means nothing. This is rather like disassembling a motorbike on the garage floor and then looking at all the bits and going, well, I've no idea what all this does. It just doesn't seem to do anything, because you've just destroyed the relationship which is in which everything exists. So we're co-creators of ourselves and of that whatever it is that exists apart from ourselves. Ultimately, we're not describing reality as if from the outside, but are immersed in it, and our understanding is and has to be participatory. And John Archibald Wheeler, a great physicist, now alas dead, said, the universe is a participatory universe. And that's a physicist speaking, not a theologian. But these elements that I continually find come together to core wisdoms. In the matter with things, I rely on neuroscience very heavily, I rely on physics less heavily, and I rely on philosophy a lot. And where you come from these three points to the center of a sphere, they cohere, and they're telling the same story. And what's even better is that story is also the story discovered by sages in both East and West for thousands of years. Another element is paradox. Paradox isn't just a mistake. Paradox is a sign, as Niels Bohr, the physicist, said, that we're at last coming to something important. And the right hemisphere is better at holding together apparently conflicting positions. The left hemisphere always wants to collapse them into one or the other. According to the left hemisphere, a thing cannot be both static and in motion, separate and connected, divisible and indivisible, precisely measurable and intrinsically imprecise at the same time. But we do know that that is the nature of reality, that these things have to be taken together very often, if not always. The right hemisphere is much less likely to ignore or simply not see whatever doesn't fit the paradigm that it already holds. So getting a new idea across in philosophy, in science, in art, depends on a lot of people dying. The great physicist Max Planck said, science advances one funeral at a time. And what he meant by that is you will never persuade people who are at the top of their hierarchy to change their minds. It's what their career is based on. If they change their minds, they'll lose that gong for which they were lined up. Their grants won't succeed. And the young in that institution will want to follow the lead of the senior person in the work group where they're engaged. They won't want to rock the boat. Also, the right hemisphere has a better idea than the left of causation. Our idea of causation is linear. A causes B causes C causes D causes E, the sound of a trumpet. But actually, it isn't like that. Lots and lots of things go to make something happen. For example, for that sound of the trumpet to go, there have to be many things. Somebody has to mine ore. Somebody has to cast it. Somebody has to write the concerto. Somebody has to play the concerto. Does the sound come from the trumpet or from the breath? We don't know. There are complexes in life, but they're not linear. And when you make them linear, you make us seem like Pavlov's dog. Ring the bell, salivation. But actually, another way of thinking about it is the dog was wise enough to know that whenever it heard the sound of a bell, somebody was going to be preparing lunch, and this was a jolly good idea. And that's a different way of thinking. The right hemisphere sees in the round, the left hemisphere just in a line. Embodiment. Everything we know is embodied and cannot be abstracted without distorting its essential nature. Spirit and body are not divided. They are distinguishable. They are not opposed. They harmonize at best. They are discernibly different aspects of the same being. Now, I'm not saying that all is contained in the body. I'll talk more about that after the break. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that there might not be something that is quite separate in the longer run. But for while we're here in this life, these two things should never be divorced from one another. And one of the elements in Christianity which separates it from most other religions is that at times in its history, it's really engaged in a war on the body, which I understand, but also deprecate. And the body reaches beyond us into the environment. So our embodied being is already connected to everything around us, particularly in the natural world. The walls of our modern buildings tend to repel that aspect. But as soon as you immerse yourself in nature, you realize that you are part of a whole here, out of which you emerge and to which you will return. It's also better the right hemisphere to understanding uniqueness. I've talked about that. But have you noticed in our culture how little it is observed of uniqueness? We are all just counters that fit into categories. And if we don't like that, then we can't be heard. We can't even accomplish anything. You've got to comply with the algorithm on the internet, or you won't get a passport, or you won't get a whatever it is you're after. And there's never a box to tick, which is the one for me, which means, well, yes, it depends on the context, or what do you mean by this word, or with whom, on which day, in which mood, you know. But that is the right hemisphere sees that. The left hemisphere has cut everything away and just has a concept there. And this is to do with what I call gestalt perception. Well, I don't just call it gestalt perception. It is called gestalt perception. And gestalt is a word we haven't got in English. That's why we've borrowed it from German. And it means a whole that cannot be decomposed into its parts without loss. Actually, no wholes can be decomposed into their parts without loss. So this is a very important idea, that the whole contains more than the sum of the parts. That, again, is understood by the right hemisphere, but not by the fragmenting analytical left hemisphere. I want to say just a few words about knowledge, belief, and truth. I've got an inkling that you might be interested in these. And they're each of them processes and relationships. Starting from truth, there are two ways you can think of truth, or there are many ways you can think of truth, but two important ones. One is that it's a thing. It's there, and you reach it by a certain path, and the further down the path you go, the closer you get to the truth, and the truth is sitting there waiting for you. But another is that truth is, as Heidegger said, unconcealing. So, and that is actually what the Greek word for truth, aletheia, means. An unhiding, an unconcealing of something. Now, this is a different process. It's rather more like the way Michelangelo created his statue of David. He didn't get an arm and put it with a leg and so on. He started with a block of stone, and all he did was throw away stone. And we call him a genius because he just threw away stone. But he did, and that's how things come into being often, is by a process of unconcealing something that was hiding there all along. And it is a relationship. As I say, it's related to trust. And the truth is what we feel we can trust in. And belief, you know, it's become very propositional. And of all the religions in the world, Christianity is the one that has the most extraordinary propositions. We have these very long creeds. They have their place. And they have their place along with the laws that Bishop Rose was talking about. Not useless, but we need to get beyond that. And the root of belief is from Leben in German, which means to love. And their modern word, Glaube, is also related to love. And our belief is, we've only maintained a sort of word that went out in the 16th century, but you can find it in Shakespeare, my lief lord. My lief means my loved one, my honored and loved. And so belief is the thing to which you give your honor, you make your faithfulness. And faith, again, is a matter of fidelity to something. It's not knowing for certain. If it were that, it would be science. But it isn't. It's something much greater than that. And it's not just random. It's like fording a stream. Somebody offers you a hand. It's not certain. You trust the hand and you cross the stream. And without trusting the hand, you won't be able to cross it. Knowledge, too, comes in important differences. So in most languages other than England, there are two words for know. One means know by experience, and the other is know as a fact. So, for example, I know that Paris is the capital of France. But I also know Paris because I spent a couple of years living there. Actually, I didn't, but, you know, you get the point. And so in French, there are two words for this, savoir, which is knowing facts, and connaître, which is making the acquaintance of something and knowing it experientially. And the same thing exists in German, the distinction between wissen and kennen. But we don't have that. And I think that a lot of the mistakes in Anglo-American analytic philosophy come from our confusing these two kinds of knowledge. And then there are important differences between different standards for truth. So the implicit and the idea of what the Greeks called mythos or muthos, and the explicit and what the Greeks called logos. Now, from muthos, myth, we get our words myth, which means probably not true. But to the Greeks, muthos was the highest kind of truth. There was another kind of everyday truth that logos could deal with, which was just working out the rational way to do this. But the great fables, the great rituals, the music, the drama, all these things helped to instill in us the muthos that would give us wisdom about the world. So the right hemisphere understands metaphor, myth, narrative, music, and poetry, and dance, I'd say, faculties that are grossly impaired in people with right hemisphere damage. The richness of these implicit paths of knowledge, which also include the things that give value to our daily lives, is essential to spiritual understanding. There's also something important about relinquishing control. The left hemisphere must be in control. It's raison d'etre is power. It doesn't like it when it doesn't have power. It feels paranoid. Something else is going on here and I can't control it. But actually, wisdom comes from not controlling, relinquishing control, and relinquishing predicting what's happening. For example, of course, you probably know the famous Chinese story about the horse. If you don't, I'll just tell you it. One day, a man has a horse, and it goes off on the hillside, and he's lost it. And everybody in the village goes, "Oh, I'm so sorry, poor you." The next day, the horse comes back and brings with it another horse. And they go, "Oh, you're so lucky. How marvelous." The next day, his son gets on the new horse to break it in and falls off and breaks his leg. And they say, "Oh, poor man, you know, what bad luck." And the man says, "Well, good luck, bad luck, who knows?" And the next day, a recruiting force from the Imperial Army comes through the town and take all the able-bodied men away. And his son is allowed to remain. And the people say, "Oh, what good luck." I think the thing is, we don't know what is going to lead to what. There are many things that we think are good that will lead to bad. And there are many things we think are not good that may lead importantly to good. We need to remember that opposites quite often cohere. I remember thinking as a teenager, the extreme left and the extreme right in politics have more in common than people who I believe have common sense and live somewhere near the middle of this. It also, the right hemisphere understands the importance of emptiness and negation. Now, those sound, well, negative to us, but we think negative must be bad. At the level of phenomenology, meditation and mindfulness succeed primarily by freeing the right hemisphere consciousness from left hemisphere processing. So part of the business of mindfulness is stilling the judgmental, categorizing, verbalizing faculty that's called monkey mind, that's going on in the left hemisphere all the time, and allowing us, instead of to live with a representation, which literally means the presence of something after it's no longer present, we can actually be there as it presences to us. And compassion meditation requires engagement of the right frontal cortex, and mindfulness engages widely distributed networks, principally in the right hemisphere. And negation, you know, this is a very important thing. What is friction? Friction is what stops movement, isn't it? But friction is also what starts movement. If it wasn't friction, I couldn't take the next step. It's very important. And negation is powerful. And it's not negative. It has positive results. Everything comes into being by being not another thing. What it is defined. And defining means there are boundaries. And boundaries means there are bits that are not in this particular thing. Which is not to say we're cutting the world up, but we're distinguishing all the wonderful myriad 10,000 things, as the Chinese say, that compose the one and all. So there's creative power in silence and stillness, something we've forgotten and we need to remind ourselves of. There's important value in not knowing, and not doing at times. Eastern traditions are full of this advice, that it is wiser not to know. And that's not ignorance. Ignorance is what you have before you know something. Not knowing is what you have after you know it. You know the famous saying, when I was seeking enlightenment, the trees were just trees and the mountains were just mountains. While I was seeking enlightenment, the trees were no longer the trees and the mountains were no longer the mountains. On achieving enlightenment, I see that the trees are just trees and the mountains are mountains. But that's a different kind of seeing from the earlier one before the process rather than what you find after it. And innocence is like this too, just as an aside. There is an innocence of a child that has not experienced, but there is also a greater innocence of a saint who has experienced and has suffered, and therefore is not innocent in the simple way that a child is, but may be innocent at a greater and more powerful level. I don't know if I've got time to talk about this, actually, but maybe I can. In the Kabbalah, and that was a Kabbalistic hymn that you heard, I've, of course, knew nothing about Judaism, really, until about 10 years ago, other than what I knew from the Old Testament. But I then started to learn about the Kabbalah from, indeed, a canon of the Church of England, who explained something very important to me. And in the process of creation, according to the Lurianic Kabbalah, there are three phases. Ein Sof, which is the ground of being, wants a creation to have a relationship with, to love. And so what is Ein Sof's first action? To go, let there be this, that, and the other. No, its first action is Tzimtzum, which means withdrawal, to create a space where there can be something other than Ein Sof. And in that space, there come urns that are placed there to catch whatever it is that's going to be created. And a single spark comes out of Ein Sof and shatters most of the vessels. That's called Sheferat HaKelim. And then the third stage of creation, which is called Tikkun, means repair. And the important things here are that humanity is called to repair these vessels. It is our calling, our duty, our obligation, our honor to be the ones who put together the broken vessels. And I'm reminded of a wonderful art form in Japan called Kintsugi, which is the repairing of ceramics to make them more beautiful than they were before, often with lines of gold in them. That is our job here. There's also something I call active passivity, which is very important. It's not just lazing around, loafing and not having anything to do. It's a kind of highly attentive skill that you need to develop, in which you're not actively willing something, but you're there to see what comes to you. And I think that meditation is like this, and I believe prayer is like this. Prayer is not so much about talking as about listening and making that space in which something can speak to you. But without the context of prayer, as well as within it, this is so. If we go to meet the world with all our concepts and language and preconceived ideas, we only see what we took there. But if we can still that and open ourselves actively to be receptive, not to put things in, but to be ready to welcome what comes, then we lead a more fulfilled and a more creative life. There is also a distinction between the way the hemispheres see the self. There are two ways in Jung's philosophy of thinking of the self. One is the ego, and the other is the true self. And the ego is what we start with, and it's strident. It wants me, and it's necessary at an early stage of development for the child to separate itself from the mother and to know that it has its own being. So that self is an ego, and that is drawn forward into early adulthood. But wisdom means that we nourish something else, which is not the ego, but the true self. And it's not something to be ashamed of, having a self. It wouldn't be better if we had no self. As a psychiatrist, I can tell you, the most damaged and difficult patients are those who have no concept of themselves. So having a concept of oneself is something the Buddha had. It's something that Christ had. It's something that is very, very important. But that is different in the right hemisphere from the way the left hemisphere sees it. It's not isolative. It's not atomistic. It's deeply the opposite of this. It's relational. And it's imbued with compassion and humility. There is also a necessary vulnerability, which to the left hemisphere does not compute. Why would you want vulnerability if your whole raison d'etre is to control? Well, vulnerability is something that's not popular these days, but it's an essential part of having any kind of relationship, is you have to make yourself vulnerable. If you don't, you'll never experience what the spiritual world, the emotional world, the moral world has to give us. And in the Christian mythos of the incarnation, there is this idea of the submission of a greater power to a form of constraint in order that something still greater can come about. This progression of potentiality to actuality, from becoming to being, involves an intrinsic sacrifice or self-limiting process in the interest of the being an actualized world at all, and the beings that live in it. The right hemisphere also sees the dark side, that is, we've lost the concept that each thing that we think good has a dark side, and probably each thing that we think is very bad has some rescuing virtue if we can find it. And we often need to in order to be able to weave our paths through life. The Greeks have a saying, when God builds a church, the devil builds one right next door. And that's a very profound saying, I think. There are things that look very much like what it is that we're seeking, but are not. And the dark side is always present. Acknowledging the dark side and being on the lookout for it is incredibly important in, our navigation through the world. It also sees the right hemisphere that suffering is not necessarily negative, but something that allows us to grow. The wonderfully great poet William Wordsworth, after the death of his brother, who drowned in the Abergavenny in 1807, that was a ship that he was on, wrote, "A deep distress hath humanized my soul." And people who have not experienced and accepted distress are not fully human and find it very difficult to empathize with and understand others. It's part of how we are built and become fully functioning human beings. And there's several lines of evidence that link depression, or the capacity for depression, which I think a lot of very thoughtful people do experience, not necessarily as a disease, but as an important accompaniment to experiencing life, going through that dark night. Several lines of evidence link depression with the right frontal pole, which is also the most important brain region in the development of self-other relationships and in empathy. So I'm going to wind up now. There are a few things that the right hemisphere has very importantly in mind that we all need, which are the great values. So much travestied during my lifetime, what has happened to truth? People are no longer ashamed of untruth. When I was growing up, untruth was something shameful and to be avoided. What has happened to beauty? Beauty is now an unword. Even artists don't want their work to be described as beautiful. They want it to be described as powerful, because the only thing that matters nowadays is power. But power is nothing, actually, just a handful of dust. What has happened to goodness? We've made goodness prescriptive, but it isn't. It's about a way of life, a way of inhabiting being, a way of approaching the world and being in the world. So those values, I'm afraid the higher values of the good, the beautiful, the true, and the holy, are really only appreciable by this broad, complex take on the world that the right hemisphere offers us. And they simply are ruled out by the single motivation of the left hemisphere, which is utility or power. It's basically the same thing. But think about this. As Lessing, the 18th century German philosopher, said, what is the use of use? It's a good question, because, okay, this is useful, but useful for what? And unless you've got another value beyond use, it has no use. Utility is futility, I say, because you need something else to guide your life. And not to push you, you know, the idea is hydraulic. The idea of these mechanistic biologists is that we're pushed by things, but we're not pushed. We're drawn towards things that call to us, that speak to us, that ravish us, that enrapture us, and towards which we dedicate our lives, often to our own cost. I mean, in superficial terms, people are willing to give up many things that are goods, according to economists, in order to have a family, to be an artist, to lead an unconventional life. These are important aspects of fulfillment of being. So, is there a left hemisphere contribution to religion at all? Well, I think it has its positive element. There needs a certain level of conceptual intelligence to recognize the something beyond at all, and the more ancient intuitive mind. So we need to have them both together. But it has so much that is negative and is active in our culture. It's less congenial to what I would call, perhaps it's a bad word because it's probably a boo word in this room, I don't know, but less congenial to the mystical, which seems to me the most profound tradition in all religions, but more to the systematic and the legalistic. It prizes the written word over the visual image or music and would tend to take the written word literally. It says so in this book. There's no arguing with this book. I'm right, you're wrong. End of conversation. It finds it difficult to live with unknowing and would claim certainty. It lacks an understanding of embodied worship, including the metaphorical nature of icons, statues, bodily gestures. It doesn't see religion as a historical and cultural phenomenon with its own context, but would see religion as timeless and universal. It believes that religion could be used to control the uncertainties of the future, perhaps through the power of prayer, and it would bring its true believers power and material wealth. I imagine very few people in this room are naive enough to believe that, but there are, as you know, there are whole strands in Christianity which have led to people believing that God favors them and their businesses will prosper, and that's the sign of the blessing of the Lord. It's unable to accept the creativity of negation or active passivity, and will have a belief simply in its own capacity to make things happen. And it would see the dark side as simply to be rejected and suffering as purely negative. So, I suppose, in fine... The right hemisphere is the one that brings us depth of understanding and humor. Such a glorious thing, humor. As I get older, I see humor as the essential counterpart of the very, very deep and serious. And in some religions, like Zen, they're explicitly connected with one another. I think that's a kind of wisdom. So our representations of reality lead us to the wrong place. We need to recover the presence of what there is here, which I don't mean just in here, in this room, but in this world. It's beautiful, rich complexity. And unless we do so, we're not going to survive. I don't mean physically, we might or we might not, but really that won't matter if we don't reorientate ourselves to the deep values of the world, which are the only things that can fulfill us. Having a relationship with one another in a society where we share beliefs and share practices, having a relationship with the natural world in which we don't see ourselves as the dominators or exploiters of that world, but of sharing in something that is way beyond utility in its beauty, and above all, the connection with the divine and the sacred, which are, after all, what the whole of the rest of it adds up to. And that it's with that that I end my book, The Matter with Things. I can't tell you, philosophers tell me, don't do this. It's an act of suicide. It's criminal. You've written this wonderful philosophical book, and it's full of science, and lots of people will love it. But you have a chapter right at the end on the sense of the sacred. Nobody will take you seriously. Interestingly, lots of people have taken it seriously, and not just the people that you might think. But it's the keystone in the arch of what I was building. What I was trying to do was take people by the hand and say, okay, you believe in a purely material world that is knowable fully by science, and the other stuff is probably misleading. And take them by steps, using science and reason, to a place where they're confronted with the divine and the sacred, and say to them, well, now, what do you think about this? And a number of people have written to me saying, I'd lost my faith, or I never had faith, or never could understand what people meant. But after reading this, I've come to see this as very important. So thank you very much for your attention, and I will carry on belaboring your ears after a break. Thank you.